It is Friday, August the 7th. Good to have you with us here on VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the race to see who'll be the next U.S. president. Also ahead, African Wildlife Foundation's mission.
It's primarily focused on wildlife trafficking and stopping the trafficking of ivory, rhino horn, pangolin scales, live great apes across international and national boundaries.
Plus, remembering the bombing of Hiroshima. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Good to have you with us again. We begin with U.S. presidential politics. Could it be? Yes, it is. Late Thursday, a number of people who would like to get the Republican Party's nomination for president gathered in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, to debate the issues. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone joins us here to look at it all. Jim, thanks for being here.
Pleasure, Steve.
And you watched all of it, didn't you?
I did. Okay. 2 hours, actually 3 hours.
Yeah, that's right, because there were two debates. Now, is that normal to have two separate debates?
No, because it's not normal to have 17 candidates for one party. So you had the top 10, according to polls, in the main debate. An earlier debate featured the other seven.
Mm-hmm. 17 altogether. Just quickly, who were the big ones?
A lot of focus was on Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He's leading in the polls. He's sort of come out of nowhere. He's a non-politician. And that was on display during the debate for both good and bad, I'd say. Trump was combative. He would respond to attacks in the debate and to criticisms. So he took no quarter there. At the same time, I just happened to catch some of the voters reacting on the Fox News channel, which carried the debate afterward. And some of them weren't too happy with Mr. Trump. They thought his tone was a little mean, and also that he was evasive on some issues. And this is where we're getting into the sort of sifting of the candidates now, Steve, where they're going to be asked specific questions, and how they respond will have an impact. So we had Trump, but we had 9 other people in there as well.
I know when he's out on the road campaigning before people, he's been to Europe. He's all over the place. The guy makes quite an impact, and a social media impact. The buzz around him, positive and negative, is great.
Yeah, and I think that'll continue with the debate. So that'll keep him in the running. He did not self-destruct, as some people might have been expecting. But we had other people in there as well. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush defending his views on immigration. He's a more moderate view than many of the Republicans. You had Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker arguing that he's one of the true conservatives in the race and should be taken seriously by Republican voters. You had also just a slew of candidates criticizing the Obama administration and its foreign policy, particularly the recently agreed to Iran nuclear deal, as well as their handling of trying to counter the Islamic State in the Middle East. So there was a lot of criticism of the Obama administration and of Hillary Clinton, a lot of attempts to tie her to President Obama, and of course she was his Secretary of State.
Right. So were they at all saying what they would do differently than what the Democrats have
in
done?
In some cases, yes. For example, a couple of them said one of the first things they do if they were elected is to tear up that Iran nuclear deal.
Whoa.
So they made a pretty strong statement on that. Others talked, Lindsey Graham in the earlier debate said, people should understand if he's elected, he'll be sending more troops to the Middle East, both to Iraq and to Syria. So there's quite a variety of views. But then you had Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who got into an argument with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie over the balance between protecting the country from terrorism here at home and also civil liberties.
Yeah.
And Rand Paul's been a big outspoken critic of too much leaning toward terrorism laws and not enough credence to civil liberties. So there were some real flashpoints in the debates.
He also has some consider a controversial point of view. He's upset that we borrow money than to give it back to countries who don't like us.
Oh, that's right. And Donald Trump makes a big point about China and Russia, and one of his big things is, as a businessman, he's going to make much better deals. He did come under questioning, though, for 4 of his companies having gone bankrupt. He defended himself in his aggressive fashion. We're going to see more of that, I think. Not a lot of clarity out of this debate right now. We've got a very crowded field. Trump's ahead, but it's not by a lot. And I think a lot of other people now are going to sort of get ready to take him on in a more aggressive way.
And when the pundits all gather together and look back at this thing, will they say there was a clear winner?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think we're closer to the beginning than we are the end of this process. So we got a long way to go.
Very long way. Like the election is how many months away?
15.
15. How about that? Many thanks, Jim. That was VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. You'll be able to stay on top of all of Jim's reporting very easily at voanews.com. In fact, he informed me a few minutes ago he was writing a piece, should be on the web fairly soon, and you'll be getting more of Jim's reporting throughout this whole campaign season. Thanks again, Jim, for being here. As we've just said, the Thursday night debate among those who want to be the Republican Party's nominee for U.S. president was divided into two debates, and our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is here to talk about it in that reference. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Let's start with Rick Santorum. The former senator is on Twitter at Rick Santorum, and he tweeted, "I'm going to take a blowtorch to the IRS with hashtag GOP debate." Another Rick, that's former Texas Governor Rick Perry, shared a tweet from his staff account at Team Rick Perry. His staff tweeted shortly after the debate that Governor Perry won tonight's debate in all caps with hashtag GOP debate and hashtag Perry 2016.
Lots of hashtags. Well, I see, G. What about the leading contenders, quote unquote? What are they saying about the debate?
Let's start with Donald Trump, the one leading in polls and also leading in entertainment value. He wrote before the debate, "I look forward to tonight's quote-unquote debate, but look far more forward to making America great again. It can happen." As for Jeb Bush, his first tweet regarding the debate was a link to a blog post titled "Jeb by the Numbers" on his website. And Scott Walker was actively promoting his Snapchat on Twitter. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with Snapchat, it's a video messaging app, and its membership is growing really fast here in the States. Steve?
Many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. A reminder, you can follow International Edition on Twitter if you'd like. You can find us at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell has praised the formation of a new coalition conservation, corporate, media, and nonprofit leaders getting together to work closely with the U.S. government to combat wildlife trafficking in the U.S. and abroad. The new U.S. Wildlife Trafficking Alliance fulfills one of the directives of the U.S. National Strategy for Combating Wildlife Trafficking. The African Wildlife Foundation was an early member of the alliance and says efforts to stop poaching and a trade of wildlife must move beyond relying solely on governments to provide the solutions. Kathleen Garrigan is the media relations manager for AWF. She tells my colleague Kim Lewis, the new alliance will work to stop the poaching and the trafficking of wild animals.
I think what we have right now is sort of two entities working on it. You have the NGO or conservation entities, and then you have the government sort of addressing it from their side, from the legal side of things. I think one of the critical pieces that's missing in that is the private sector. And there's still a real knowledge deficit in the United States about the crisis. As much as we in the conservation community and sometimes in the media know about it, I think of your average citizen, probably it's still not really on their radar. So by bringing in some of these private sector partners into the fold, you know, the Amazons, the Facebooks, Google, we're really hoping to utilize their platforms, their resources, their perspective on how you mobilize and broadcast messages across the U.S. to sort of fill that knowledge gap.
And we also saw how effective social media can be with the recent incident in Zimbabwe with the trophy hunting, the shooting of the lion mm-hmm. Cecil, and how social media information was passed along through that before it even came to the mass media, the television and radio stations. Looking at the alliance itself, how will trophy hunting be affected by the alliance, or will it, since it is considered a legal mm-hmm. type of activity?
The alliance is the coalition that's been designed to address wildlife trafficking, which is quite different from, as you pointed out, the legal hunting that's going on. You know, I think the two issues sometimes get a little bit conflated, and there's certainly different dynamics and drivers behind each of these different industries. It's primarily focused on wildlife trafficking and stopping the trafficking of ivory, rhino horn, pangolin scales, live great apes across international and national boundaries. Now, as we saw with Cecil, I mean, that is the power of social media right there. You know, a lot of people were not aware of trophy hunting in Africa. They were not aware that this industry, there were certain abuses in this industry. And what we saw with Cecil, thanks in large part to social media and the media, is this sort of snowball effect. You know, it was like a trickle at first with people starting to learn about what was happening, and then it just exploded into this outpouring of support and, in some cases, outrage.
Kathleen Garrigan, Media Relations Manager for African Wildlife Foundation. She was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. 50 years ago, U.S. lawmakers approved it, and President Lyndon Johnson signed it into law. It was called the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The measure outlawed racial discrimination in voting and provided the necessary federal enforcement to allow millions of African Americans in many parts of the southern United States to exercise their right to vote. The law followed years of protest as well as civil unrest and even bloodshed. VOA's Chris Simpkins has our report.
History was made when President Lyndon Johnson signed the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The law is widely considered to be the most effective piece of civil rights legislation ever enacted in the United States.
We will not turn aside until Americans of every race and color and origin in this country have the same right as all others to share in the process of democracy.
The Voting Rights Act wiped out state and local barriers at the ballot box in communities throughout the South that racially discriminated against voters. It also provided for federal enforcement of the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which gave African Americans the right to vote.
The Act of 1965 freed and liberated so many people.
John Lewis, now a U.S. congressman, was nearly killed during a voting rights march in Selma, Alabama in 1965. Scenes of the violent confrontation in which police attacked peaceful demonstrators caused a national outcry and led to swift passage of the Voting Rights Act.
It was worth the suffering of so many people. It was worthy of the blood that some of us gave.
Political science professor Andra Gillespie says large-scale government-backed efforts were launched to register black voters.
The voting rate among African Americans climbs exponentially during the latter part of the 1960s and early part of the 1970s. So there were places in the South, states where hundreds or thousands of blacks could vote.
Black leaders say the sacrifices made to win voting rights should be celebrated and never forgotten. Leo Smith directs minority engagement for the Georgia Republican Party.
I am proud that we have gone from a society where I might have been attacked and beat down like John Lewis was, but he took those wounds for me. Don't waste the blood that was spilled by pretending that his suffering meant nothing.
50 years later, Former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin remembers how the 1965 Voting Rights Act gave her an opportunity to seek elective office.
Fortunately, other people saw something in me I didn't see in myself, and they encouraged me to step out of my comfort zone and to run for office. And so my mission since that time has been to encourage other people to do the same.
Political analysts say the Voting Rights Act was a victory for the nation by making one of the most powerful instruments in a democracy, the vote, fair and equitable. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Washington.
Thursday was the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, that forestalled the U.S. invasion of the Japanese home islands and helped bring an end to the Second World War 9 days later. Estimated 80,000 people were killed immediately on August the 6th, 1945, a death toll that would rise to about 135,000 in the days and months to follow. To mark the anniversary, American author Rodney Barker is offering an electronic version of his 1985 book, Hiroshima Maidens. That's the story of how 25 Japanese women, crippled, disfigured by the effects of the atomic blast, were brought to the U.S. in 1955 for treatment, including plastic surgery. It is a story of their pain, their shame, courage, as well as their hope as they sought to remake their lives. Well, Barker was 9 years old when his family opened the doors of their home to two of these women, as well as to two Polish women who survived Nazi medical treatments. Barker's e-version of Hiroshima Maidens is being offered online free through today, August the 7th, at rodneybarkerauthor.com. It's also available, they tell us, at Amazon. Barker told VOA's Victor Beatty, what is so significant about this anniversary is that aside from the second bomb, which was dropped on Nagasaki 3 days later, no nuclear weapon has been used in wartime since.
I mean, I think there's a reason for, I guess you'd say, celebration. I mean, certain things have happened that made us not repeat that. So it's a cause, I guess you'd say, to commemorate 70 years. But it's also an opportunity to reflect on the meaning of it. I mean, one of the things that I think concerns me a little bit is that there are probably more people alive on this planet now who were born into a nuclear age who know nothing different. And for those few that remain that remember the significance of the dropping of the atomic bomb and what it started, I mean, these anniversaries with zeros in them are opportunities to reflect on that.
In the wake of Hiroshima and the Nagasaki bombings by the United States, the U.S. briefly held a monopoly. Then it's expanded to the Soviet Union and beyond. And now we had just the discussions with Iran about controlling its nuclear program. Proliferation continues, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. That gives a contemporary relevance to this anniversary, too. To look back, to think about it, to think how significant it was, and to rethink that, you know, how small that bomb was in comparison to what's available today, and to understand what the, you know, why it's been so important in that we negotiate some kind of controls over it. And there have been a series of bilateral controls over the years since the bomb has been dropped, and finding some way to slow it down, like in Iran too, is something that's important. And this is another occasion to sort of to reflect on the importance of that. And I can't speak to the details of the negotiation, but that it certainly is being taken seriously by all parties is significant.
Are you concerned that with the proliferation of terrorism in the world that it's just a matter of time before some group gets a hold of an atomic device?
Sure, that's one thing. You know, when the arms race first started between the United States and the Soviet Union, it started like who could build the bigger bomb and then who could build more bombs. And it reached a point where there was a recognition on both sides that, yeah, there's a phrase, you know, that all we're going to do is make the rubble bounce, and that the value of considering these as weapons to be used, you know, is not either of our security. So then we begin to sort of negotiate treaties and to scale that back. But I don't think that the terrorists, you know, have given any indication that they have that kind of restraint and that their use of this would be done without the same kind of awareness of the implications of it that the Soviet Union and the United States do, which is why I'd like to see Russia, not the Soviet Union, the United States work a little more closely on controlling nukes in any form.
The argument at the time, 1945, was that as horrible as this weapon turned out to be for the victims of the A bombing, this would ultimately lessen casualties and avoid a very terrible invasion of the islands.
And there was a legitimacy to that, too. When you go back to World War II, at that particular stage when the bomb was being developed, it was believed, or certainly it was said at the time, that it's actually saved American lives and Japanese lives that it would have been lost in an invasion of Japan. The book I wrote, The Hiroshima Maidens, these were women who were schoolgirls at the time, who were quite badly disfigured in the atomic bombing, who were brought to America 10 years later for plastic surgery, and who did not come bearing anger or resentment or blame on America, but in fact, you know, showed profound appreciation for the compassion showed by Americans, and even went further than that into kind of a unique survivor response in that what they felt is there should be no more Hiroshimas. And so they became almost advocates for peace, and that's kind of a unique survivor response in war.
Hiroshima Maidens author Rodney Barker speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
This is Bisbee.
Trophy animal hunting, while banned in some regions, is still an established business in parts of sub-Saharan Africa. For example, South Africa's big game hunting industry employs some 70,000 people, and some 9,000 trophy hunters visit South Africa each year. Herman Meyerdix, a professional hunter, says trophy hunting can help to fund conservation projects.
It must be to the benefit of the community at large. In the area where it takes place.
But some argue countries could benefit more from the tourism revenue big game animals attract. Beth Allgood of International Fund for Animal Welfare says via Skype, trophy hunting revenue makes up just a fraction of Africa's economy.
For Zimbabwe, it's 0.29% of their GDP, and travel and tourism is 10% of their GDP.
But the question for African communities is whether trophy hunting and tourism will be able to coexist far into the future. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. It has been 16 years since rapper and entrepreneur Dr. Dre released a solo album. Now he's out with what he says will be his final album. Proceeds from the CD called Compton will go to benefit a performance art space in Los Angeles. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA music host Ray McDonald about the new album and why it took so many years to be released.
Dr. Dre has been working on an album called Detox for many, many years. And this was sort of the holy grail of hip-hop. People were waiting and waiting and waiting for Detox to appear. And now we find that Dr. Dre is coming out with an album, but it's not Detox. It's called Compton, a soundtrack by Dr. Dre. It was announced Thursday on Zane Lowe's Beats One radio show, and the album officially premiered Thursday night, and it hit the market on Friday.
Now, he is known for working with other people. He's worked with Snoop Dogg. Obviously, he worked with N.W.A. He worked with Eminem. He's been producing a lot of people, in addition to coming up with the Beats headphone or sound system line.
He's been busy.
So he has been busy. It's just we haven't heard him solo since the album 2001, which was released in 1999.
Well, Dre has his own radio show on Beats One. It's called The Pharmacy. And he says that he was working on Detox for years and years. But he said it wasn't good. He didn't like it. He knew that the fans wouldn't like it. So he basically abandoned that project, brought together a lot of established stars and some newcomers, too, and he made Compton a soundtrack. Eminem, of course, Kendrick Lamar, Ice Cube, Snoop Dogg, The Game, Exhibit. They're some of the established stars. And then he works with some new artists like King Mez and Justice. And Dre says he wrote most of the lyrics for the album with those two. So they're newcomers, and they're going to be getting a lot of great publicity from this album.
So it's going to establish their cred by being with him, and it's also going to give us a chance to hear Dr. Dre again.
For the last time, he says this is going to be his grand finale.
Wow, okay. So you might have an opinion on this. You can send us a tweet. It's VOA underscore music and VOA underscore IE. Those are our Twitter handles. And, of course, you can listen for Ray's show. That's the top 5 hits and the top 20 hits of the week. You can download that at www.voanews.com.
You know, I've heard that Dr. Dre's Beats headphones that he's come up with has made him a multimillionaire just off the headphones. Can you imagine? Well, people in Chile got the first chance Thursday to see Hollywood's movie about the 33 miners who captured the world's attention by surviving trapped deep underground longer than anyone before. The film, called The 33, was released in Chile a day after the fifth anniversary of the mine collapse. Spanish actor Antonio Banderas and French actress Juliette Binoche star in the film that dramatizes the disaster and the miners' globally televised rescue, all of that happening back on August the 5th in 2010. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In September, the U.S. Congress will vote on whether or not to disapprove the comprehensive nuclear accord agreed to last month by the P5 plus one countries and Iran. In a speech in Washington defending the deal, President Barack Obama was blunt.
The choice we face is ultimately between diplomacy or some form of war. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not 3 months from now, but soon.
Mr. Obama added that, ironically, military action would be far less effective than this deal in preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Every estimate, including those from Israeli analysts, suggests military action would only set back Iran's program by a few years at best, which is a fraction of the limitations imposed by this deal.
Mr. Obama called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, the strongest non-proliferation agreement ever negotiated, permanently prohibiting Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon by verifiably cutting off all Iran's pathways to a bomb, thereby securing one of the U.S.'s critical security objectives by means of hard, painstaking diplomacy. President Obama noted that all problems with Iran are not solved by the nuclear accord.
The ruling regime is dangerous and it is repressive. We will continue to have sanctions in place on Iran's support for terrorism and violation of human rights. We will continue to insist upon the release of Americans detained unjustly.
Mr. Obama decried the rhetoric and behavior emanating from some parts of Iran, calling it offensive and incendiary. But he said that superpowers should not act impulsively in response to taunts or even provocations that can be addressed short of war. Just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America, he said, does not mean that's what all Iranians believe.
The majority of the Iranian people have powerful incentives to urge their government to move in a different, less provocative direction. Incentives that are strengthened by this deal. We should offer them that chance. We should give them that opportunity.
It's not guaranteed to succeed, said President Obama. But if they take it, that would be good for Iran. It would be good for the United States. It would be good for a region that has known too much conflict. It would be good for the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.